The Olympics are in the news this week. Not next year's games or the ones after that, but the 2024 Summer Olympics.
Those games could be held here in the United States if a bid from snowy Boston is successful. The city is making its case to host the games, but there are dissenting voices there saying the benefits wouldn't be worth the costs. Those are estimated at $9 to $10 billion, with more possible money going to transportation infrastructure.
In a new book, our next guest weighs these issues and how they've played out in past Olympics with past Olympics hosts. Andrew Zimbalist is a professor of economics at Smith College. His latest book is called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup. Andrew, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Well, you make the case right up front that hosting the Olympics is kind of an economic gamble for the host city, but yet it seems like cities are lining up to be in that role. Why is it such a tempting thing for cities?
Well, a few things. First of all, in fact, prior to what is now going on with respect to trying to host the 2024 Olympics, since roughly 1997, there has been a declining number of cities interested in hosting either the Winter or the Summer Games. And in fact, what's happened over the last 18 months with regard to the Winter Games for 2022 is that four European cities have dropped out of the bidding. Three of those cities had referendums where the people overwhelmingly voted that they didn't want to host. And in one of them, in Norway, the government of Norway was asked to financially backstop the bid in Oslo, and they said they wouldn't do it. It was too expensive. And so you had four dropouts, and the only two cities that are left right now are Almaty, Kazakhstan, and Beijing, China, both of which have very serious problems as potential winter hosts. And of course, both are from authoritarian countries where it doesn't matter nearly as much what the people think about budgetary priorities. What happened during the course of these cities dropping out of the bidding to host the 2022 games is the IOC changed presidents, and a new fellow by the name of Thomas Bach came in. He realized there was a problem that nobody wanted to bid for the games. And he made a couple of changes. And one of those changes was that he started traveling. The moment he came into office, he started traveling around the globe, talking to executives in cities, trying to get them interested in bidding and saying that they'd be a very viable candidate for the next round. And the other thing he did is he introduced some reforms, which at least superficially pretend to be sympathetic to the host cities, but make very little concrete change. So now, for the first time, really since 1997, you have a bunch of cities wanting to do it again. But I should qualify that. When I say a bunch of cities, really what it is a bunch of groups within cities, groups of private industry executives who push this bid. And that's certainly the case in Boston. There's not been a political vote either in the city council or the state legislature to endorse the bid. The bid is being done by Boston 2024, which is a group of private industry executives who find it in their self-interest, their private interest, to have the games in Boston, because especially the construction industry executives, they're going to get all the contracts if Boston hosts the game. That's quite a different matter than saying the city itself has decided that it wants to host them. And in fact, polls have found that while 51% of the people said they'd be in favor of Boston hosting the Olympics, that's only if there's no public money. If you say there's going to be public money, then only 33% are in favor.
Well, Andrew, I want to jump in and ask, mentioned please. There might be some winners here and losers. Is that historically the case that maybe a business community counts comes out ahead after the Olympics and others, maybe lower income people, come out behind?
I think there's generally that distributional pattern, yes. One of the things that happened in Rio, which is quite typical, is that in order to find land first for the World Cup that was hosted there in 2014 and now for the Olympics in 2016 in Rio, is they had to level favelas, which are kind of shanty towns that are in the hills surrounding the city. And people who were living in the favelas, if they had title to their land, they got they had a new apartment given to them that was maybe 20 miles to the west of where they lived before. So it became very difficult for the breadwinners to continue in their job, and very difficult for their kids to continue to go to school. If they didn't have a title, then they were just left on their own. So there has been a general pattern of neglecting the interests of lower income people, and certainly the executives from certain industries can benefit mightily from a hosting situation.
Well, and speaking of patterns, are there patterns besides those you just talked about that bring better outcomes to the host cities?
Well, it's happened before. There are a couple of examples in the past that I point to in my book that I think were successful examples, and one of them was Los Angeles in 1984, another was Barcelona in 1992. What happened in Los Angeles in 1984 was, however, singular, because the previous three Summer Olympics had all been, in their own way, rather disastrous. In Mexico City, in 68, there was violence. 200 students got killed. There was the Black Power protest on the American team. Very bad optics from that. In 1972 in Munich, the Israeli compound was raided by terrorists, and 16 people were killed. In 1976, Montreal hosted the Games, and they had a cost overrun of 9.2 times greater than their initial bid. So that was a financial disaster. And so when it came time to bid for the 84 games in 1978, nobody wanted to host, which is the situation that had just recently existed again. But in 84, nobody wanted to host. And finally, a private group from Los Angeles said, we'll do it on two conditions. So they said to the International Olympic Committee, number one, you have to financially backstop the games, which has never happened before and never happened since. IOC said yes. And then the second condition was that you have to let us use the facilities that we used back in 1932 when we hosted the games, and the IOC said yes again. So Los Angeles didn't have to put any public money into the games at all. And they got the IOC to backstop it. And on top of that, Peter Uberoth, the head of the games, did some very effective management and very aggressive corporate sponsorship promotion. And he started a new model of corporate sponsorship that the IOC inaugurated right after in 1985. As a result, Los Angeles had a surplus of $215 million. The circumstances in Barcelona were also very special, but I can stop for a second and give you a chance to answer another question.
We're talking about the economics of the Olympics with Andrew Zimbalist, and we have Arnie on the line in Madison. Arnie, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I had the opportunity to serve as a consultant on the 1994 Winter Olympic Games in Lillehammer, Norway, and that was quite exciting because they were attempting and were advertising it as the Green Games, and that they would try for environmental sustainability and also leave a rather small footprint after the games were over. And in fact, those venues are being used right up to the present by the local community. Why do you think that particular model, at least for the Winter Games, which are typically smaller, didn't go very far, and especially as we see what happened at Sochi?
Arnie, interesting perspective. Thanks. Andrew.
Yeah, so the problem with the Lillehammer Olympics is that there was overbuilding of hotels and of the ski resort itself, so that many of the hotels went bankrupt or sold off for a dollar. At the end of the day, the economic reports based on the Lillehammer experience do not indicate that there was any economic benefit, and indeed that there was a lot of investment that turned out to be quite wasteful. The caller is correct that the Winter Olympics are substantially smaller. The Summer Olympics these days have 10,500 athletes. The Winter Olympics have less than 3,000 athletes. And, of course, there are many, many countries around the world that participate in the Summer Olympics and don't participate in the Winter Olympics. There are over 200 in the summer, and they're under 100 in the Winter Olympics.
For a city like Boston, what would you want Boston to think about if it is successful in this bid to host the 2024 Olympics?
Well, part of the problem is that practically every single city that's ever hosted the Olympics, Barcelona is an exception, does not have a city plan before it develops its Olympic plan. So they decide to bid for the Olympics, and all of the structural changes and the investments that are being made in response to what the IOC requires. They're not being made in response to what democratically elected planners or urban designers are deciding what they want to do with the city. So in other words, there's no prior urban design about this is what we want our city to look like, and now let's see if hosting the Olympics is congruent with that vision. Rather, what happens is there's no design, and the IOC comes along with the demands for 32 or 33 venues and all sorts of other things. Boston is in this group of a city without a design. And so what happens is that very scarce urban land ends up getting used for Olympic facilities and an Olympic Village and Olympic Media Center, and then you have to feed that center with parking lots and transportation routes and so on and so forth. You end up spending, to host the Olympics these days, you spend between $15 and $20 billion. The amount of money that comes in from all of the Olympic sources during the 17 days of the Games is about $3.5 to $4 billion. That's a very bad financial balance, and the only way you can make that work, the only way it can be justifiable, is if that you get some long-term benefits from it. There's a claim always that's out there that you'll get more tourism, you'll get more trade, you'll get more foreign investment, but the econometric studies don't sustain that claim.
And we leave it there. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Andrew Zimbalist, professor of economics at Smith College. His new book is called Circus Maximus, The Economic Gamble Behind Hosting the Olympics and the World Cup.